Dear friends, now we will talk about the treatment options for pre-malignant lesions, the treatment options for cervical intraepithelial neoplasia or dysplasia. And in my lecture here, I would concentrate mainly in the context of developing countries. And I would emphasize that the management of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia will involve certain amount of over-treatment. And the over-treatment is pragmatically essential, because in many developing countries we will think of a single visit approach where we do screening and treatment on the same day, or screening, diagnosis on and treatment on the same day. So you may be treating a number of people without lesions. So there is some amount of over treatment involved in single day treatments, but this is inevitable. By using single day treatments, you can single visit approaches, you can maximize the link between screening, diagnosis and treatment, or screening and treatment. So unless you treat the lesions cannot be cured and cervical cancers cannot be prevented. So my deliberations here will predominantly are related to the conditions prevailing in low and medium resource settings. You are all aware about the natural history of cervical precancers. And persistent infection with one of the 15 types of human papilloma viral types is the necessary cause for cervical cancer. In fact, all women, I would say practically all, for all practical purposes, all women in their lifetime will be exposed to HPV infection. I would say this is an ubiquitous infection. More than 90% of the women in their lifetime would have been infected with HPV infection. But fortunately, in a lot of them, it disappears by itself. At any given point in time, in sexually exposed women, anywhere between, say, 5 to 30, 40% of the women will be positive for HPV infection. And in fact, in about 80% of the women infected with HPV infection, the infection clears within 2 years. In fact, in half of them, infection clears by 6 months, in about 80% by 2 years, and beyond 2 years, beyond 3 years, the infection persists in about 10% of the women. So these are the women in whom a cervical metaplastic cell, epithelial cell, can be potentially converted into a neoplastic cell. And we saw, we discussed earlier the different stages of cervical carcinogenesis, and we talked about CIN1, CIN2 and CIN3. And in fact, a CIN1, more than 80% of the CIN1 either regresses into normal or doesn't progress into CIN2. And CIN2, about 10 to 20% of the CIN2 progresses to CIN3. About 30% may remain persistent as CIN2, and about 50% regresses into lower grades or normal. And among CIN3, 50% of the CIN3 will progress to invasive cancer within, say, 10 to 15 years unless treated, but about 25% may persist, and about 25% may regress. And cancers, they never become normal. They invariably progress into higher grades and leads to death. So the essential message here is lower grade cervical intraepithelial neoplasia have a tendency to regress, a higher tendency to regress, whereas a higher grades of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia like CIN3 have a higher tendency to progress to invasive cancer. And in fact, I would say, dogmatically, if you leave 100 patients with CIN1 untreated, especially CIN1 patients above the age of 30 years, about 10 will become invasive cancer within 20 years. If you leave 100 women aged 30 years and above with CIN2 untreated, about 20 women will become invasive cancer within, say, 15 years. If you leave 100 women with CAN3 untreated, about 50 women will develop cervical cancer within, say, 15 to 20 years. So that means for every 2 CAN3 patients you treat, you save 1 woman from developing cancer. For every 10 women treated with CAN2, you save 2 women from developing cervical cancer. And for every 10 women, let me be a little more generous, for every 20 women with CAN1 you treat, you may save 1 woman from developing cervical cancer. So that means with lower grade, you are treating a large number of people unnecessarily, but we don't have any reliable markers at the time to say which woman will progress to cancer, which woman will not. The most important principle of treatment of CAN is the principle that the whole transformation zone should be treated. The depth of treatment in the cervical epithelium should be at least 7 mm. And the treated patients should be followed up to assess whether they have been cured of the neoplasia or whether they have a recurrence. And if you recall our previous lectures, we always emphasized cervical neoplasia occurs in the transformation zone. So the transformation zone is the zone of the cervix between the original squamocolumnar junction and the new squamocolumnar junction. From a clinical perspective, this is the part of the cervix which surrounds the os. To me, it is the most simplest way of identifying the transformation zone. And we also said the crypts in the columnar epithelium, they infiltrate into the stroma. And in about 95% of the women, the stromal depth of infiltration by the crypts or the cervical intraepithelial neoplasia does not exceed 4 mm. And that means if your depth of treatment of the cervical epithelium for cervical neoplasia is at least 7 mm, you are giving enough depth of treatment for most cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. And then the third principle, because of the fact that women who have developed cervical intraepithelial neoplasia are at a higher risk of developing new lesions as compared to normal women, so you have to keep them under surveillance. So how frequently you survive them, how frequently you see them will depend upon your resources. In developed countries, of course, they would like to see them every 6 months. We cannot have that luxury in developing countries. I would say if you follow up a woman 1 year after treatment in developing countries and you ensure there is no residual lesion, this is good enough for most women. What are the treatment methods for treatment of CAN? The treatment can be divided into two groups, ablative or destructive treatment and excision treatment. The ablative treatment techniques are cryotherapy, which relies on using a refrigerant gas like carbon dioxide or nitrous oxide to cool down a metallic probe to minus 20 degrees Celsius with carbon dioxide and minus 60 degrees Celsius with nitrous oxide. And using that cooled probe to bring down the temperature in the cervix very rapidly down to, say, less than minus 20 degrees Celsius so that the intracellular water crystallizes and the cells are destroyed. The second ablative technique is electrocoagulation. You use an electrically activated electrode to coagulate the cervical epithelium so that you destroy the cervical epithelium to a depth of up to 7 millimeters. Cold coagulation, it's a misnomer. It should be a heat coagulation. It is not using cold, but it is using heat to coagulate the cervical epithelium. So here, a metallic electrode is heated to, say, 100 degrees to 105 degrees, and it is applied on the cervical epithelium, and the cervical cells are destroyed. Then the fourth ablative technique is laser ablation. We use laser beam to destroy the cervical cells. Essentially, all ablative and excisional ablative or destructive treatment can be done on the cervix without local anesthesia. Why without local anesthesia? The ectocervical epithelium lacks pain-sensitive fibers. There is no pain nerve endings in the ectocervix, so it doesn't feel touch or pain. So that is why you don't need to give local anesthesia when we use the ablative techniques like cryotherapy or cold coagulation. Without local anesthesia, one can do. And whenever your treatment involves the stroma contains a lot of pain nerve endings, and whenever your treatment involves the endocervix, which contains a lot of pain autonomous nerve endings, then you will require local anesthesia. But for ablative treatment involving the ectocervix, you don't require local anesthesia. And again, ablative treatment is reserved only to those lesions which are totally in the ectocervix, doesn't involve the canal. So if the lesion is involves the endocervical canal, or if the lesion involves the vagina, we don't use ablative treatment. And similarly, ablative treatment is restricted to smaller lesions. When we say smaller lesions, the lesions involving less than 3/4 of the cervix, 3/4 of the cervix or less. And when the lesion involves 4/4 of the cervix, ablative treatment has a higher failure rate. But in Africa, in many places where you don't have facility for excisional treatment, I would encourage even using ablative treatment for 4/4 lesions, provided the lesion doesn't involve the canal. So how do you ensure the lesion doesn't involve the canal? You should see the lesion in its entirety on the ectocervix. The squamocolumnar junction is fully visible and the lesion doesn't go into the canal. And whenever you clinically suspect invasive cancer, ablative treatment should never be used. Why? Because the invasive cancers involve a larger depth of the cervix, so you may undertreat such lesions. And ablative treatment is not a sufficient treatment for invasive cancer. The second set of treatments are called the excision treatment. As it implies, it involves excision of the cervix. So what are the techniques? The first technique, which is the most widely used ablative technique, excision treatment, is the loop electrosurgical excision procedure, which is called LEAP, or it is also called large loop excision of the transformation zone, LETS. Both are same. Where you excise the entire atypical transformation zone with an electrically activated electrode under local anesthesia. The second technique is laser ablation. Using a laser beam, you excise the cervical epithelium, the transformation zone. The third technique is cold knife conization. Using a surgical knife, you excise the cervix in its entirety in the shape of a cone, which is usually the cone is like 1.5–2 centimeters in depth. And then finally, you remove the entire uterus, which is hysterectomy, which is seldom used for management of cervical precancers. Excision treatments, about 80 to 90% of the excision treatments are usually LEAP treatments. And cold knife conization is usually reserved for very large lesions. Whenever you suspect an invasive cancer, or when you suspect a glandular neoplasia like the adenocarcinoma in situ. And the excisional treatments are usually reserved for large CIN involving more than 3/4 of the cervix, or the CIN involving the canal, extending into the canal, or in a typical transformation zones, you are not able to see the squamocolumnar junction in its entirety. So generally excision are when you suspect an invasive cancer in the lesion. So these are the usual indications for excision treatment. The transformation zones can be divided into three types: type 1, type 2 and type 3. Type 1 is a fully visible transformation zone. One can trace the squamocolumnar junction in its entirety. So the lesions occurring within this type 1 transformation zone are totally ectocervical and visible. And lesions occurring in type 1 transformation zone are suitable for ablative treatment. Type 2, it is a partially visible transformation zone, and you cannot see the squamocolumnar junction in its entirety. But by manipulating the endocervical canal with a cotton bougie or a cotton swab or with an endocervical speculum, you can visualize the entire squamocolumnar junction. Type 3, It's only partially visible transformation zone even after the manipulation of the endocervical canal. Type 2 and type 3 transformation zones containing CIN will require excision treatment, whereas type 1 can be treated equally effective by both excision and ablative treatment. So what are the indications for ablative treatment like cryotherapy and cold coagulation? And I would emphasize, in developing countries, laser ablation is very expensive because equipment is very expensive. We will not consider that. And the only possible ablative treatments are cryotherapy or cold coagulation or electrocoagulation. Of this, we would recommend either cryotherapy if you can ensure availability of gas, or cold coagulation for treatment because they are more feasible. So what are the indications for ablative treatment? All these five indications should be satisfied. It should be a lesion occurring in type 1 transformation zone, and the lesion involves less than 75% of the cervix, which is less than 3 quadrants, less than 3 quadrants, and there is no endocervical canal involvement. There is no evidence of invasive cancer. And if there is pathological services are available, one can direct a biopsy before giving the ablative treatment. So after treatment, you know what you are treating. As I said earlier, excision treatment is indicated for large type 1 transformation zone, if there is more than 3/4 of the cervix, or when the lesion involves the endocervical canal, or if you suspect glandular lesions like adenocarcinoma in situ, and whenever you suspect invasive cancer. So you will resort for excision treatment. CIN treat for the management of CIN. A CIN treat technique usually involves a loop electrosurgical excision procedure simultaneously to diagnose and treat premalignant cervical disease in screen-positive women in one visit, thereby eliminating the need for a second visit for treatment. What's the advantage? You save time and you ensure treatment for screen-positive women. Then there is a second situation, a CIN treat with cryotherapy or cold coagulation. CIN treat principles can be adapted to achieve maximum compliance of screen-positive women for diagnosis and cryotherapy or cold coagulation in one visit. In a test-and-treat single-visit approach, one can use combination of VIA and HPV testing and cryotherapy or cold coagulation. VIA positive or HPV positive women with no clinical suspicion of invasive cancers receive cryotherapy or cold coagulation without colposcopic or biopsy triage. This is usually in countries like sub-Saharan Africa where there is no facility for colposcopy and biopsies. And the safety, the acceptability, the efficacy of such approaches have been already demonstrated in Thailand and several other developing countries. Test and treat single visit approach with a combination of VIA and cryotherapy or cold coagulation is usually resorted to sub-Saharan African countries or in settings where there is no biopsy services available, no histopathology services available. It is impossible to process a biopsy specimen. And in such cases, VIA positive women with no clinical suspicion of invasive cancer receive cryotherapy or cold coagulation without colposcopic or biopsy triage. As I already said, this approach has been extensively used in several African countries and shown to be acceptable and safe and effective. So I am going to deal with cryotherapy in detail in this lecture, and we will be dealing cold coagulation in a separate lecture. So cryotherapy is the technique of rapidly freezing the cervix to below minus 20 degrees Celsius temperature so that the intracellular water in the cervical cells are crystallized, resulting in destruction of cells. It is a safe procedure with practically no complication. The action is by crystallizing the intracellular water, which pierces the cytoplasm and destroys the cells. And when you reduce the temperature very rapidly, the temperature at the core of the ice ball within the tissue with it reaches minus 89 degrees Celsius with nitrous oxide and minus 68 degrees Celsius with carbon dioxide. The temperature at the edges of the ice ball reaches like minus 20 degrees Celsius. As I said earlier, the indications for cryotherapy are all the following. They are similar to the ablative therapy. Any grade of lesion can be treated, CIN1, CIN2 or CIN3. Acetovoid lesions or mustard yellow lesions, the lesion can be adequately covered by the cryoprobe or extends 2 mm beyond the diameter of the cryoprobe. The lesion is not cancer. The lesion is entirely located in the ectocervix. The lesion does not extend into vagina or endocervix. Lesion involves less than 3/4 of the transformation zone or the cervix. There is no history of pregnancy, no history of menstrual bleeding. All these indications should be satisfied for cryotherapy. The instruments and equipment you need include the examination table, halogen focused lamp, a bivalve speculum to expose the cervix, the instrument tray, and the cryotherapy unit. And before providing cryotherapy, you should always elicit the history for anaphylactic reactions for any drug or a history of diabetes, hypertension, renal failure, bleeding disorders, history of repeated pelvic inflammatory disease, history of menstrual period, and history of pregnancy. So, this is the equipment for cryotherapy. You need the cryoprobe. We advocate a standard cryoprobe with no ectocervical extension. And the cryotherapy equipment consists of a cryo gun, which is used to regulate the flow of refrigerant gas to the cryoprobe, so that the cryoprobe is heat is brought down to sub-zero temperatures, and then this cryoprobe is applied on the cervix. And the cryotherapy equipment should have a pressure gauge, which shows the pressure at which the gas exits from the gas bottle through the cryotherapy equipment. And in fact, the cryo gun, the monitor in the cryo gun shows a green zone where the needle should be to indicate the pressure of escape of the gas is adequate for freezing the cryo probe. If there is a very high pressure, there is a possibility of explosion, so that the pressure should be brought down by letting out gas until the needle reaches the green zone of the monitor in the cryo gun, the monitor of the cryotherapy equipment. Usually, this doesn't happen when you connect the cryo equipment with a nitrous oxide bottle or a tank containing carbon dioxide. The pressure gauge usually shows the green safe zone. Coming to the cryotherapy procedure, the woman is lied down in modified lithotomy position. The procedure is explained to the woman. She is reassured, and be kind to the woman so that it's fully relaxed. Insert the speculum, expose the cervix, remove discharge, apply acetic acid, delineate the lesion, and then apply the Lugolsidin, delineate the lesion, and set the timer, and wipe the cryotic probe with the saline solution, and connect the cryoprobe with the gas tank. Keep everything ready, and when you are ready, set the timer, apply the tip of the cryoprobe on the cervix firmly, and then start freezing. Freeze for 3 minutes and then stop freezing. You wait for 5 minutes for the cryoprobe to thaw, and then again you freeze for 3 minutes. It is called a double freeze technique. So 3 minutes freeze, 5 minute thaw, 3 minute freeze. Why this thaw? If the tissue temperature is brought down to say -60°C for 2 minutes, by physical principles, the tissue no longer conducts heat. So that is why you have to stop freezing after 3 minutes and allow the tissue temperature to rise, so that when you freeze again, the temperature is still conducted. Why we do a double freeze technique? We want to ensure at least 7 millimeter of the cervical tissue is destroyed. Once you have done the double freeze, that is 3 minute freeze, 5 minute stopping freezing for the probe to thaw, and then again 3 minute freeze, then stop freezing and wait for the cryoprobe to defrost, and remove the cryoprobe by gentle 180 degree rotations without pulling it abruptly. Then one inspects the cervix for bleeding. remove the speculum, reassure the woman, and advice for follow-up care, which includes there should not be any douche, no vaginal tampons, no sexual intercourse for 4 weeks. If sexual intercourse cannot be avoided, advise the use of condoms. But despite this, in many places people commence sexual intercourse without the condoms, and we have not seen excess complications. And one, advise the woman there may be some mild cramping and clear watery discharge up to 4 weeks. And we always prefer to administer routine antibiotics, presumptive antibiotics, prophylactic antibiotics, either with metronidazole 400 mg BD for 5 days or doxycycline 100 mg BD for 5 days. There is no trial evidence that this helps, but we would prefer this in developing countries to prevent future infections. We do not know whether it really is worthwhile, but certainly we practice it. And before a provider is made to treat a patient with cryotherapy, they should practice the use of the equipment in vitro, in physical models. A best way of doing this is using an apple and a cotton soaked in water, so where the provider can learn how to freeze and defreeze and thaw and things like that. Here we are showing our trainees in Thailand being trained in cryotherapy in an in vitro lesson before the actual in vivo treatment. This shows the position of the cryoprobe on the cervix to ensure adequate contact with the cervical epithelium so that the entire transformation zone is frozen. So here we show a cervix with a lesion and how the probe covers the entire cervix, the entire transformation zone, and the cervix is being now treated with acetic with cryotherapy. So you can see the ice ball around the probe, and then after stopping the freezing, the ice ball disappears, the probe thaws, the tissue thaws, and then the probe is withdrawn. So these are the appearances of the cervix immediately after freezing, after 2 weeks and 3 months, after 1 year. And usually the wound heals within 3 weeks from treatment. Complications and side effects of cryotherapy are fewer. Some women may complain of some lower abdominal pain or cramps, vaginal pain or cramps. Sometimes complain of a freezing feeling in the lower abdomen. Very rarely fainting attacks, especially this occurs when you freeze the endocervix, which has a lot of autonomic nerve fibers. So never use a cryoprobe with an endocervical extension. Very, very rarely an anaphylactic shock has been described. Actually, in literature, only 3 such descriptions. In our own experience, out of more than 10,000 treatments, we had 2 episodes of anaphylaxis. Vaginal discharge for 2 to 3 weeks is very common. Usually it is profuse and watery. And occasionally one may see a light bleeding or spotting in the first week, especially if you have done cryotherapy after directing a biopsy, a punch biopsy. And infection of the sloughing area can occur rarely. But in our experience, such complications are very, very, very few. In fact, out of more than 10,000 treatments, we have seen all these complications in less than 1% of the women. But you should instruct the woman, if any one of these symptoms occur, they should promptly report to the doctor or the provider. Fever for more than 2 days, severe lower abdominal pain or cramps, bleeding heavier than heaviest days of menstrual bleeding immediately after treatment, bleeding with clots, and excessive foul-smelling discharge. This may indicate some problems, so that this can be properly examined and avoided. As I said earlier, the post-cryotherapy instructions include no vaginal douche, no vaginal packing or tampon, no sexual intercourse for 4 weeks, use of condoms if abstinence cannot be ensured. Usual physical activity can be resumed soon after treatment. This is a very, very important advice to people. There is no need for taking rest after cryotherapy. You know, after cryotherapy, 30 minutes after the cryotherapy, the woman can walk, go home and start their work. There is no need to take leave from work. There is no need to take leave from their physical activity, their livelihood and things like that. This is an outpatient treatment. So don't advise 1 week or 2 weeks of rest after cryotherapy. This is not the case. People can start working 30 minutes from treatment. Long-term sequelae following cryotherapy are very rare. A true functional stenosis very, very, very rarely has been described. Pelvic inflammatory disease is again very rare. And there are no adverse effects on fertility and pregnancy. And in fact, we have seen in many women, after cryotherapy, they conceive because the canal becomes patent. Follow-up care. After 6 to 8 weeks, you may recall the woman to assess healing. But generally, we have given up this step now. We know that the lesion, the wound heals within 3 weeks. But we invariably now advise, after 1 year from treatment, we call them back and assess the cervix to see whether the lesion is healed and there are no residual disease. If there is residual disease or recurrent disease, whatever you want to call them, you may treat them again. So cleaning, decontamination and disinfection of the cryotherapy equipment after each treatment is important. Decontaminate the cryo unit hose and regulator by wiping with 70% ethyl alcohol. Wash the probe vigorously with soap and water and then dry it. And you can do high level disinfection by boiling the probe in water for 20 minutes or soaking it in 4% glutaraldehyde. If the above HLD options are not available, soak the cryoprobe in 70 to 90% ethyl alcohol for 20 minutes. For all practical purposes, we clean them vigorously very well with water, dry them, wipe it with 70% ethyl alcohol and freeze the cryoprobe for three minutes. I think the probe is ready for next use. This is the practical decontamination disinfection I would advise. Again, I repeat, in the field, you clean the probe clear very well with water, wipe it with a dry cotton, and then wipe it with a cotton soaked in 70% ethyl alcohol. And again, freeze the probe by connecting with the cryo equipment for 2 to 3 minutes, and then the probe is ready for reuse. Okay, now we will deal with excision treatment. An excision treatment is mandatory if the previous treatment for CIN has failed and there is a large lesion in the cervix, or in cases where the squamocolumnar junction is not visible so that the endocervical canal involvement may be there, which you cannot exclude. And when you are unable to obtain a direct biopsy from a burst area, and whenever invasion is suspected, and whenever glandular lesions are suspected. We will deal here essentially with loop electrosurgical excision procedure. So it is the use of radio frequency electrical current to cut tissue and to achieve hemostasis. This technique is the loop electrosurgical excision procedure. It involves an electrosurgical unit which generates the electric current and a patient plate electrode which completes the circuit with the patient and the machine, which is grounded, and a tungsten wire electrode which can be heated so that which is used for cutting the cervical tissue. The indications for LEAP include cervical intraepithelial neoplasia confirmed by histology, histologically confirmed CIN lesions extending into the endocervical canal, which is not more than 1 centimeter, histologically confirmed large ectocervical CIN lesions that cannot be covered adequately by the largest probe, no evidence of invasive cancer, no evidence of pregnancy. Of course, these particular indications, histological confirmation is possible only in countries with capacity for histopathology. This is not possible in many sub-Saharan African countries. Here the LEAP indication will include whenever you suspect clinically a glandular lesion or cancer, or whenever the lesion is very large, it involves more than 3/4 of the cervix, or the lesion involves the endocervical canal. So the LEAP eligibility criteria, again, CIN confirmed by biopsy or suspected CIN, or large VIA-Willi lesions in Africa. Depth grade no greater than 1.6 centimeter. And then whenever possible, you will like to treat the infection before LEAP, but in most developing country situations, you cannot ask for too many repeat visits, so that essentially, we will go ahead and then treat and then put the patient on presumptive antibiotic treatment. So the technique of LEAP, prepare the patient, one has to get consent, put her in lithotomy position, explain the treatment, make her relaxed, You use local analgesic anesthesia to make the cervix pain-free, and you use the loop which is an appropriate size, small and medium or large. Mostly we get away with a small or medium loop, and the appropriate diathermy settings should be chosen, and we always simulate the cutting procedure before commencing the actual cutting. So the steps will include the steps in performing the leap procedure will include: you plan the loop, place the loop on the cervix, allow the current to cut through the cervix and exit from the cervix. Always we plan a side to side or posterior to anterior cut, never from anterior to posterior. And you always look before you leap, and while you are doing the leap procedure, you should look at the cervix and control the technique so that you don't inadvertently cut the vagina or the vaginal folds. The surgical approaches for leap will include a one-pass procedure when you can remove the entire ectocervical disease with one pass. This is usually type 1 transformation zone. If the lesion is very large and you cannot remove it with one loop cut, then you may remove it with multiple passes. If the lesion involves more than 1 centimeter into the canal, then you use an excision of the ectocervix first and the endocervical disease later using a two-step procedure called cowboy hat procedure. And then of course you can excise the entire ectocervical disease with a long and needle cylindrical resection. There is another technique one may use. So this is the schematic representation of the one-pass procedure. So here, after local anesthesia, which is given at 12, 3, 6 and 9 o'clock positions, or diagonally at, preferably I would prefer diagonal choices, like you prick at 2 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock and 11 o'clock positions, avoiding the blood vessel tips. So that you can infiltrate the submucosa with local anesthetic, so that the cervix becomes analgesized, anesthetized, locally anesthetized, and then you cut the lesion laterally from side to side. Here the lesion is cut from the left side to the right side. The entire transformation zone is removed in one pass. And after cutting, the tissue is removed, and then fulgurate the wound and the wound margins with a 5 millimeter ball electrode to achieve hemostasis, as well as to keep the squamocolumnar junction on the ectocervical canal. This is the schematic representation of the multiple cut procedure, where you remove the large portion of the ectocervical lesion with one cut, and then remove the lesion on the lower lip and upper lip, so that you have three multiple cuts here. This is the schematic representation of the cowboy hat procedure. So one first cuts the ectocervix, and then cuts the endocervix, so that a large chunk of tissue is removed. Then the special circumstances: if the lesion extends into the vagina, ball electrode is used for fulgurating the peripheral vaginal part of the lesion, and the leap is used to cut the central part of the lesion. And one has to be careful with previously treated cervix, so that the cervix is distorted, so you have to align your cut in such a proper way so that you don't cut the surrounding tissues. And when they are lax vaginal walls, you should be particularly careful not to cut the vaginal walls by using vaginal retractors. With an appropriate technique, complications for a leap treatment are fewer. In about less than 2% of the patients, there could be a primary hemorrhage, and this can be controlled by rollerball diathermy using a 5 millimeter ball electrode or using Wansel's paste. Secondary hemorrhage can happen after 24 hours after leap, and in that case, infection should be suspected and should be treated. And if it doesn't, and it may require a suture and packing. And a vaginal burn is by means of a careless technique. Infection can rarely happen, cervical stenosis rare. And there could be a slightly elevated risk of a threatened abortion following leap. But usually with single cut procedure, this is practically nil. The adverse effects are again very rare. There could be some perioperative bleeding in less than 2% of the cases. And some people have some bloodstain discharge for 2 or 3 days. And postoperative bleeding may occur in about less than 5% of the patients, but with good technique this can be avoided. And the chances of infection are rare, provided aseptic techniques are used. Long-term sequelae of LEAP. And as I said, the long-term sequelae are very rare. A pure stenosis is very rare. And the pelvic inflammatory disease is also rare. Okay, follow-up after LEAP. You may call this woman after 1 month to see whether the wound has healed and review her after 1 year to ensure the lesions have been cleared. And for all practical purposes, these are the only two possible review mechanisms. But in case opportunities permit, you may recall them every 2 years or every 5 years to assess, but this is seldom possible in developing countries. Now, I give some cure rates with the cryotherapy in field settings where the nurses provide a treatment in the field. So you see here, in a large series in India, cryotherapy provided by nurses in field conditions in a population-based study, 94% of the patients were cured with a single treatment with cryotherapy. Of course, the cure rate is very high with CIN1, like 96%, and drops down to 82% with high-grade disease. And again, with the LEAP, among 459 patients, about 94% were cured with the LEAP. And as you see here, the cure rate is high for CIN1, around 98%, drops down to 85% to CIN3. But of course, with repeated treatment, more than 95% of the patients can be cured. So what is the achievement of cure? You prevent invasive cancer. And then again, in another large field-based study with cryotherapy provided by nurses and loop provided by doctors, the cure rates were quite high, so more than 90% cured with the cryotherapy and around 90% again cured with LEAP. This is in another study in India. They are all in low resource settings, in settings with a lot of resource constraints. And as you see here, in this large series of patients in India treated with cryotherapy followed at 1 year, among 2,094 patients, the side effects of cryotherapy were less than in 0.5% of the patients, so they are practically negligible. So for all practical purposes, I would say that these are treatments which can be provided on outpatient basis by trained nurses and doctors, and the safety profile is quite high and they are effective and they essentially prevent invasive cancer in properly selected patients, essentially VIA and VLE positive patients in sub-Saharan Africa.